contracts, how many people here are allowed to know what GIS is? Does everybody know what GIS is? Is anybody still doing it? Okay, so thank you for admitting that. Then I'll go quickly through. I have a piece about what is GIS, so I thought there might be some people in line. Those of you who know about it, maybe I'll be useful in line. So I'll end that with I need to also admit that this talk is about 3 years old. I made it about 2 years ago. And as I sat down to bring it up to date to see where the field had gone from when I first made this talk, surprisingly, it hasn't gone very far. So much of what I had to say 3 years ago is still alive, which is surprising. And many of the websites that were in my original talk still look exactly the same. And some of them are even gone, of course. And the interesting thing that I found in here is that a lot of the projects that are where people are trying to extend GIS to the humanity are dead end. They don't seem to be going anywhere. But nevertheless, there are some interesting, for me as a GIS scientist, no matter whether these projects die or not, they're very interesting. They're posing interesting questions. That's why I ask how to look at this area and see how humanity can write some new questions for us. Okay. I'm a left-handed motion. There we go. We got it. Okay, now I have the proper button. There we go. Okay. Both of these quotes were from the 90s, and I thought that they were worth keeping in, despite the fact
despite the fact that they're older, because they still apply. And the first one was something from the American President's Technology Advisory saying that information technology will drive progress in the 21st century. Well, we know that. But what was more interesting was a quote that I found by the man who is the president of the National Academy of Engineering in the U.S. And this is a quote from 95, so this is like 11 years ago. But the head of the engineering academia in the state said that he doesn't think science is going to make the most dramatic impact, but it would be the applications in humanity that are going to be the most important in the new technology field. And I thought that was very interesting that the engineering, an important person in engineering actually acknowledged that. So here's my what is GIS slide. This is simple. This is just the textbook definition of it. When I teach my class, this is not what I call, I don't define GIS like this at all. But in a quick definition of GIS, it's simply an information system for geographic information. Really the most important thing to think of when you're thinking about what is GIS. It's an information system like all the other information systems. So the basic technology and structure of it is an information system. We have databases and SQL and all that stuff, just like any other information system. The key is that we have geographic information, and that's where it gets really tricky. The geographic information is completely different from other kinds of information. So therefore, it's an organized collection of software and hardware that deals with geographic information. Now, the next two slides are just pictures of geographic information. The basic kind of geographic information is the map. That's historically where all geographic information was stored, on maps. And maps are an amazing summary of spatial information, and it's over centuries techniques were developed to demonstrate to us things on the land, like the brown lines here are contour lines. And anyone who's familiar with a map knows that that indicates elevation. But that actually had to be developed as a technique. And then the blue lines by our protocols tend to mean rivers. And then there's this block here that clearly must be a city. And so we understand these maps, but they do represent things distributed in space. So that's our standard kind of geographic information, but there's lots more geographic information. This is also geographic information. It's a table. But the first column, which I've got named here, is geocode. A great deal of the data that we have in tables has at least one column in it that has a geographic reference. It might be a place name. In this case, it's a code, which might reference to a census zone or a district or a postal code or something that is a number for a region. So once you know that all of these rows here are associated with a particular place, it becomes geographic information. And if you have the map of that place, you can make a map. It's also geographic information because it's got addresses, it has zip codes in the U.S., and telephone numbers. Those are three different kinds of information which can be vaguely associated with places on the surface of the earth. So once I can associate any of those things, or the addresses in particular, to dots, then I've got geographic information. Geographic information can also come in very fuzzy forms, like sketches, which represent someone's idea of what a place looks like. It can come in text like this, which is from the Bible. I just went into this website and looked for the word boundaries, because boundary is a very geographic feature. So I searched the boundaries and found this whole section of text which describes the boundary of the land of the Israelites. And you could follow that and draw the line on the map. So it's a very explicit description of geography. This is geographic information. So in terms of the humanities, geographic information comes in lots of different ways. It comes in maps, and often a sketch map, which means they're not purely accurate, but they still have useful information on them. They come in records about objects that have been collected. Things like archaeology in particular are very precise about where they find everything on the ground. There's usually some sort of grid reference or some sort of locational reference in the data that's collected, or the tables that are collected about artifacts that are picked up. Business records from a trading company, which is a historical document, may well say where things have been shipped to or where they have come from or where the client, the purchaser lives. All of that is geographic information that's buried in this in the diary of a traveler, a really nice piece of geographic information. You could follow their trail. Agricultural land inventories, lots and lots of those, particularly in places like China, where they've done a lot of inventories over hundreds of, or many decades, or centuries, that you have agricultural land inventories that attach production to a particular place on the land. All of these are the kinds of, are examples of geographic information you would find in the humanities. Geographic information is different, as I said before. So GIS is a geographic information system. So the information system for geographic information. And as I said, once we make it geographic, things get complex. And we have all sorts of interesting things go on. For one thing, geographic data are spatially dependent. Now, that's a big topic, and I could do a whole lecture on that. But it does mean that if you are looking at, let's say, agricultural records, and you've drawn a map of all the different fields with different kinds of crops, you're going to find that within one region, it's going to be similar crops. And then it will change into another region, and then all the farms there will have similar crops. That's spatially dependent. Almost all geographic information comes like that. And the important piece here, which doesn't necessarily have to do with humanities, is that dependency in our data makes it difficult to do traditional statistical analysis. If you've done any stats, one of the basic assumptions with ordinary statistical methods is that all of your observations are independent. Independent is a fundamental assumption in statistics. But spatial data is very dependent, so that two observations close to each other are actually very similar. So doing statistical analysis with spatial data is actually not a good thing to do. Another thing about geographic information that's offered is that the locations are on the curve of the Earth. So that finding locations is not just an X and Y coordinate. You've got to deal with a curved Earth. I mean, if you're dealing with a large area, then you have to deal with projections and all sorts of complexity. Geographic data has a spatial key with at least two continuous dimensions, latitude and longitude. We measure it continuously, but when we put it in the computer, we have to discretize it. So you have to take things which are measured continuously and make them very discrete, because computers can't contain continuous data. And this is the key thing that makes geographic information different, is location is a universal integrator. So, for example, here we can integrate through location in this spot here. So right in this spot here, we can say there are lots of things going on. We're in a building, we're in the city, we're in a country, the air temperature is something, the elevation is some number, the length is not anything, let's just put zero. Down there on the ground, I don't know what's under the ground, but I said it was fluvial. There's a district and there's a land parcel and there's a number of people per square mile and there's an average age of the people in this parcel, but there's a number of bags of oranges or whatever. In this particular place, we can measure all these different things. So we integrate all of this information right through this space here. And that's a very, very powerful tool. This is a classic picture of it. Once we have geography and we have things distributed in space, the next thing we get out of this is the ability to work with geographic relationships. And this is one of the really most promising things for humanities scholars, is to be able to take data that has not been mapped, put it on a map, and then begin to see these kinds of really interesting relationships which aren't shown when you have data in a table. So just quickly to play with some of these. You can measure distance between points. If you just have your data in a table, you don't know how far things are apart. And distance between things will make a big difference in the relationships that one city will have with another. Scale is something that we do a lot in GIS. It depends how close you look, how much detail you get. And so if you can zoom in on a place or zoom out from a place, you can get a different perspective on it. Proximity is really important, and it's related to distance. But with GIS, if you put your dots on a map, you can see which things are close to one another. You can build neighborhoods of similar things. So you can group things that are the same and put them into neighborhoods, and therefore give them some sort of similar categories, which you may find useful in trying to understand what you've got. You can figure out clusters. You can figure out patterns. Spatial patterns is one of the really very powerful things you can do in GIS. Do you see a spatial pattern there yet? Does that help? And often the spatial patterns you can't actually see. You have to actually use the algorithms that GIS provides to extract the pattern. Sometimes they're just too busy. You can draw boundaries by calculating them. So GIS has been really big in a lot of fields. These are the business fields that GIS is often referenced to. And of course, you don't see much there in the way of humanities. And if you look at the humanities and start looking at these topics, they don't look a lot like the other ones. And there is a reason why GIS is slow to come into the humanities. It's because the style of scholarship in the humanities is different from the more scientific approach that is what's been driving GIS. Humanities focus on preservation, transmission, and interpretation of the human record through a study of historic documents and cultural objects. The key thing here to a humanities scholar is that when is the most important dimension as opposed to where. But place does matter, even though traditionally the humanities scholars may not have actually paid attention to it. So their focus has been on time, and what I would argue is that adding place to time adds another whole spectrum of valuable analytical possibilities. So in the humanities, scholarship in the humanities, as I was working with the humanities scholars 2 years ago, it was interesting to see the nature of scholarship in the field. It's very solitary, or has traditionally been very solitary. A scholar in the field will have a study area and a topic, and they will spend their whole career collecting information about that place and that topic. And that collection of information becomes their currency for all of their scholarly work. So they tend to keep all these little cards in little boxes and organize them and reorganize them and write books about them for many, many generations. They do all their research in their grad studies. Well, that's not true, but some of them will have done all their research in their graduate work and maybe boxes of data and then spend the rest of their career sifting through that data. So they tend to be very solitary and reflective. So they find a relationship and then they explore it through their data. They actually do rely on multiple sources, which seems means GIS has some value here because we can give them multiple sources. And their methods are non-numeric normally, although this is changing quite a bit because there's actually now a digital humanities community, but this is the traditional one, and serendipity is important. This is important because that's exactly what GIS can give you, is insights by adding in another whole theme to an understanding of a place. Suddenly there's a new relationship you never saw before. So it's actually speaking straight to us. On the scientific side, we have a different method that's understood to exist. And it's got hypotheses and predictions and collecting data and doing things that can be repeated and working in teams. Quite a different style from the humanities goes. So, in general, just outside the GIS part, or bigger than GIS, there is a big move right now in humanities to digitize everything. And that is actually, while it's an endless task that will never be finished, by putting everything in the computer, it really changes the nature of the field. Then you can start searching through transcripts and actually finding those little nuggets of information you'd really like to know about. These databases can contain, there are some really interesting projects around where they're digitizing every single document they can find about a place. Every single document. I have some example later on. By putting every single thing in the computer, then you can start searching through those databases and try to find these little connections. You can bring together artifacts that have been distributed around the world. A lot of these projects are scanning paintings or taking really good photographs of art objects. And by putting them on the web now, if a collection has been dispersed through different museums, they can be brought together virtually, and an art historian can actually look at these objects all together, not manually, but virtually, and get a chance to understand them. So this is an amazing thing for humanities scholars. And then, of course, everything can get related to GIS. So what does GIS offer? GIS offers context, and this is the big thing. It puts all of that data and artifacts and information into the land, into space. And heightens the awareness of the physical impact of places and regions and the structure of human society. So my next question says, but is it GIS, geographic information, or geography? I put that in there because when I started working with the humanities scholars at Berkeley, now probably 10 years ago, they kept asking me to help them put GIS in their database. They wanted to add GIS to everything. That's not the right language. It's not GIS you're adding. It's this understanding geographically that they wanted to add. They wanted to implement it in GIS. So the question isn't really GIS. It's a question about whether we're talking about geographic information or even the studies of geography. So this is a summary of the rest of my talk. Geography, different ways we can use GIS or variations on that theme. So I'll just move on. Geography is a means of indexing archives. So the first one is you just have a bunch of things that you've got, pictures, photographs, or artifacts, or whatever, and you make sure you have a location identifier on each record, and then you can just put, a dot on the map. So one level is just simply to put a location identifier on every record, and then you can map the locations of all of your artifacts in your collection. And already, that gives you some information because you see the distribution of your artifacts in space, and all of a sudden says, you know, if I have a certain, these are maybe coins, a certain kind of coin, well now we know how far they've been distributed. Another way is to use geography as a means of structuring the data collection, and this is pretty obvious, is that if you are collecting something that's very dispersed, these were just some examples, it's good to organize it by some framework, and geography is a good framework to organize it with. So perhaps you're trying to study the spread of a particular sect of Buddhism. than if you were to follow it geographically rather than to follow it through literature. You might, you know, find a different way of collecting your information. Geography is a means of integrating artifacts, ideas, texts, etc. This is one step beyond the first example I had. And in this case, they use geography as the means of connecting all the pieces together. So rather than just coding all your collections, you actually code many different things together. This example of this project from the British Library is still quite active. The website, all of these websites, they don't really good at designing websites. They're not really intuitive playlists. They look like they're going to be really neat. They get in there and you stumble around and don't get very far. But nevertheless, with this project, this is signed into all these very in-depth tours of this area. And took photographs and wrote these large journals and really, really rich information for historians. And so what they've done is they put it all on the map, put everything together so that you can navigate through the collection by navigating through the map from different scales. And then you get zoomed in and you can see his trail and you can see the places where he stopped. And associated with each of those places, you get the hand-drawn maps that he did. You get the photographs that were taken of places that are there. You get maps of the different things. So all these pieces are connected together through the map. And so you can go to one place and connect all these pieces of information of the collection together. Okay, geography of context. This is the one I mentioned earlier. In this project, they have studied two different communities just before and during the American Civil War. And there's one community from each side of the war, so the North and the South. And they're fairly close together, but the dividing line between the two sides is pretty close to where they were. And so they got into these two communities and collected every piece of information they could find across this about 10 or 15 year period. They have voting records, they have the census records, they have the church records, they have records from businesses, they have diaries, they have military records, they have records about the slaves, they have everything they could find. They digitized it all, and then they started to connect it again through a map. They went in and they found some maps that described the area of the two communities. This is one of them. It's not a very good picture of it. But this map had every single house on it and had identified for every single house, had an identifier for every single house. So with another document, they could figure out who lived in every single house in this community. And then with that name, they were able then to attach lots of other records, like insurance records and slave sales and agricultural production through their names, which they then were able to put onto the map. This is just a map showing how it actually digitizes. Then they could start doing things like, the red dots are all the houses, and the yellow dots are all the churches. And they knew for each house which church people belonged to. And then they could figure out, you know, whether they were going to the nearest church or not. And it actually turns out often they weren't. They would go much further to go to a different church, which seems to have something to do, say, with, you know, the community they wanted to be attached to. But this kind of analysis you would never be able to do without the map. And it's a whole other understanding of this community that would never have come through without being able to put those dots on the map. This is an example of how deep they could go. That map gone on top of it. But they had maps that were this detailed, and they had each little house, and they could identify the name of the person, the tenant, the owner. According to that particular building, there was an insurance policy. It had a value of a certain amount. It said what was going on in the building, or what was made of, and then lots of other things they could attach through that geography. Oh, not, this is, of course, in the 1800s, so not then.
Oh.
Yes. No, of course not, right? Right. No, this is all dead stuff, right? They were able to look at the slaves and all sorts of other things. So once they got all this stuff, they could do it. Yeah, you wouldn't do it now, but it's really great in a historical context to get all that data and be able to connect it. Okay, so the next level, after we've just sort of connected everything in space, is to actually start to look at how things relate to each other. And there are some really classic now examples of people trying to use maps to understand their studies. The Hartlow database, I don't know when he did this, but it was quite early in the 20th century. This guy did, was an influential social historian of middle period Chinese history. And he's one of these scholars who went out in his earlier years and collected all this data. And then, as he got older, he decided to digitize it, put it on cards, punch cards, and put it into the computer. And he started to crunch it and started to draw maps, fairly elementary maps, that he was able to begin to see how the social culture of the area expanded because of its geographical location, rather than just understanding it in a social sense. Another example, this one's pretty simplistic in my mind, but I understand from what she said, it was very revealing for her. So she's a historian, she studies print culture, which is books, historical things about how books are published and what kinds of literature is published in what kinds of places, and about the publishing industry. So her work had been looking at the geography of book production, but then she started to look at how it related to everything else in the communities in which it was existing. And as she started to look at it, she began to understand why a certain style of writing would evolve from one place to another, because if she then looked at the trading records, she could see that the trading records would take books from there to another place. So it wasn't like a social thing, it was a trading thing. And so it completely changed her analysis. This is from that study by Fiona Black that she set this little table up, and I thought it was interesting to see, because this is a table we use in GIS a lot, or a table like this. These are a bunch of spatial questions. What is at a location? Where is a condition? What has changed since? What has changed on the surface in some trends? What's the distribution, or what are the patterns? And what would happen if I move things around? So she used this thing and discussed how many booksellers were in New York and the surrounding area, which she could only find by doing this on a map. What towns had more than one newspaper? Well, that's not necessarily a spatial thing, but by seeing which towns, then she could make some analyses. Were there more special bookshops in certain towns with a certain proportion of Scottish immigrants, which she did get by all the conversions? So, point of note. Basically, that's the thing, yeah, and hope for some serendipitous revelation, which is the manner of humanities scholarship in the slow method, and this is sort of like speeding it up really fast. Indeed. Okay, so the next level of going just not looking just at the relationships, but is to actually impose spatial analysis on your data, which is taking it really fully into the GIS and imposing some mathematical techniques to analyze the data to see if you can come up with patterns that aren't apparent just when you look at the map. Spatial analysis, just as a definition, is a set of techniques whose results are dependent on the locations of the objects being analyzed. This is a nice classical definition of spatial analysis. And what it means is that if you move the objects, you get different answers. And that's when it becomes spatial analysis. So something like, this is not a very good, I think a better example. If you have a population map of a large country like the U.S. or China, you can see where the center of population is. You know, most of them are in the southern part. The center of population would be down in the center part. If you move the people, the center of population would move, obviously. But if you move the people, the average income doesn't change in the country. That's not a spatial thing. So the spatial analysis, the answers depend on where the things are. And most traditional statistical techniques don't care about space at all. So there's a whole bunch of statistical techniques or analytical techniques that you can do. These are just names of them. They're all fun to play with. And I'm not going to go into any of them. I just have the list there. I'm going to go into a couple here because these ones are nice and visual. One of the neat things you can do with GIS is this thing called view sheds. You put your items on the landscape and then extrude it so that it becomes a three-dimensional landscape, the real one we live in, which makes a lot of sense in Hong Kong. And so that if you looked at things on a map or on a flat plane, you wouldn't notice that there was a mountain range between these two. And obviously this mountain range would make it difficult for a community here and a community over there to collaborate. And if they were on a flat plane, it's much easier to communicate. So the landscape itself is very useful. And there are some more advanced tools we can do where we can actually do... I bet the button. All my pictures are in behind this because my mouse got put out of order. Let me just fix that. Okay, let's see if it works now. Yeah, there we are. Okay, if you're in this spot here, you can figure out the view shed from the spot. And so everything you can see from the spot, it implies that they're kind of down behind a mountain, a little ridge here, so they can't see back up here. This is all the area that you could see from that particular point. And you can do that. It's very easy to do with the GIS. Then if you're trying to see how this group relates to this other group, you could do a view shed up there and discover that they really couldn't see each other, so they couldn't be communicating for military purposes or something like that. But this is something that would not be evident unless you actually ran a view shed analysis. You could figure out these boundaries, but if you don't have lot, there are some problems with figuring out boundaries. You'd have to play some games. Another one, this is probably going to be the same thing. This is what happens when I size my file smaller. For the elevation at 2 points, you can do an interpolation and figure out the elevation in between them, which is pretty straightforward when you're looking at the map, but if you don't have the map, you can figure it out. And it might be really useful to know. There might be a shrine or something in this point here, and by doing interpolation, you can figure out its elevation, which would imply something towards its value. Another thing you can do, and this is getting into the temporal component, is you can do interpolation on the temporal and spatial scale. This is the rise of the Mongol Empire, the rise and demise of it. And it's not a very good graphic, it's really old. But it just gets the point across that you can show these kind of things. And if you could take this one, actually there's this great one on the website now where they have several different empires all growing and reducing at the same time. So you can see them coming in and conflicting with each other and the one going away and the other one expanding in. And again, it's something you couldn't do without a tool like this. And lastly, I have geovisualization, which is putting events in time and space. And this isn't a very good illustration of something that's actually animated, but basically this is a bunch of battles in the Civil War, and it shows you as the troops move from one battle to the next, and you can see them moving around the landscape. And it's a much better understanding how the battles progress by seeing it. Oh, and finally, a virtual world. this again is not the world's best example, and there's some wonderful ones now where they've reconstructed whole cities in 3D, this 3D model, that, where you can really see how a place exists. This is an analytical one. It's kind of a funny picture, but basically this is a map laid over a surface of elevation. Right where the sky is, there's a mound that puzzled the people. It had something to do with the early people in the area had built this mound, but they couldn't figure out what the mound was for. And so they did a viewshed analysis and discovered that it really was the center of a radial point of view, and it gave them a different sense on the value of that spot. So that spot actually was in the center of a large viewshed. But they didn't actually pick that up until they did the viewshed analysis. So by putting that mound in a virtual world, they were able to understand its role. Okay, so those are all the things. This is the last one on my list, is GI science and humanities research. GI science is the science which underlies the technology and underlies our ability to work with geographic information. We study things like how geographic information represents the world. What are some of the cognitive problems we have with geographic information when we put it in computers? So if you think about the field of GI science and put it in humanities research, you have things like areas of study which might be examining the role of place and geographic context. How important is it to have those things to understand in the field? That would be a cognitive thing. Seeing one's own discipline from a new perspective. That's really very important. This is where some of the great insights are coming, where people are taking old studies, putting them on the map, and suddenly getting different insights on how that field could actually exist, and merging and modifying formal methods. So what does a geographic perspective offer? Maps give new dimensions that no other mode of analysis can provide. There is actually this huge growing awareness now of what the value of geography is. Google Maps. It's the best promotional tool we have right now. Everybody's picking up on geography. So there's a growing general awareness about how geography works and constraining what's going on. And so it clearly leads into understanding history and social things. Maps and geographic references and text are a largely unmined historical data resource. This is really important. In all of that historical and humanities data, there's geography in there that no one's using. There's a huge amount of research opportunities within stuff that people have already been looking at for many, many years because it's got these place names in there. If you took all that stuff and put it on a map, there's a completely different analysis possible. There's a huge amount of data that's just completely unmined. So the geographic perspective challenges old assumptions, suggests new ways of doing things, and promotes exploitation of data. This is just some quotes on the same thing, which are, this is by a presentation at a conference. I really liked when he said this. The electronic ordering of data with GIS software accordingly arms the researcher with a weapon with which to resist the obedience commanded by established traditions, anthropological debate, or kindred traditions. So he says that the traditional methods bind people to doing it the same way, but if you can break out of that and put your stuff into GIS, suddenly you're free of that, and you can pursue new lines, which, because of their volume and gravity, relentlessly pull the trajectory of scholarly investigations into themselves, and let depth stars inexorably consume their life. This is the traditional thing. He's saying all those traditional methods kill the field. So if you can break out of those traditional methods by trying something new, the field will be suddenly enlightened. So that's what I said. You can do all those things, but this is the problem. How do you do it in GIS? How difficult is it to do humanities things in GIS? And as it turns out, it's not all that easy. One of the problems we have is that the humanities are fundamentally qualitative when GIS is quantitative. If you're going to put it in a computer, you've got to have everything as numbers. And yet the humanities work in words and qualitative relationships. How do we take all that qualitative stuff and put it in the computers? And there is some question, you know, the folks in the field who are familiar with working in qualitative are uncomfortable if everything becomes quantitative, because then you pay attention only to those things you can put in the computer and you ignore the things you can't, the qualities, the essences. And then there's another whole piece about culturally defined conceptions of space and place are really rich, that the way a community understands their place is very hard to put in a computer. And so the reason why a community exists in their space in a certain way and uses it in a certain way may not be something I can put in the computer. And so I may not be able to understand it by putting it in the computer. So that's a problem with qualitative things. These are some of the issues. So, but let's say we want to do it. So the first thing is, do we have data in the humanities? Data in the GIS sense. Stuff I can put in my computer. And humanities scholars don't think of their stuff as data. It's not data. I call it data, but they wouldn't think of it as data. So somehow we have to convert their collections of information into data. And then they have to find out whether they actually have spatially referenced data. And if they have spatially referenced data, what kind of geographies are they using? And this is a bit tricky because sometimes they're not using a geography that's easy to put in the GIS because they're not thinking spatially. So they've developed some sort of geographic reference that may not be appropriate for the kind of spatial structure we need. So what does where mean to them? That they may be recording locations in a sense that reflects the culture, but doesn't so much reflect the strict geography. So the challenges we have are in these three areas. The first one is just simply making qualitative information quantitative. And that's hard to do. It can be done, but it takes a certain perspective. And in fact, one of the things it does is it makes you look differently at your data. If you have data that describes locations as being near to something or close or almost at, you know, all these sort of fuzzy words, to put that in the computer, you have to somehow quantify those, but it means you then have to look at your data and go, what did I mean by near? Why did I use the word near and not beside? Was I trying to imply something different by using that word? So in fact, the process of trying to quantify these things makes you go back and look at the choices you made in your language and helps you understand some structure that you have in your language, which isn't apparent when you're just using it fluidly. So trying to quantify things that are qualitative imposes a structure that may be wrong, but may help you understand more deeply why things have actually been described the way they were. So the other thing is place, and as I mentioned before, you've got to find, if there's geography in this data, you've got to be able to connect it to the map. And this is a big problem because a lot of the places are historical, they're not around anymore, or they're named something differently than other references might name them. So you have a real problem with places. We have a really good tool, though, which is the Gazetteer. And this is one area in this field that has had a lot of work done, and they're still working even more on it. The Gazetteer is simply an index which relates a place name to a location. That's what it does. If you put in the place name, you get the location, like the latitude and longitude. And there's lots of these around. There are two or three that are the definitive ones. But they're digital now, so you can send your file to these Gazetteers and they will return to you the list of X, Y locations. And some of these Gazetteers are getting smart now and they have temporal components so that a place name, you give it a place name and a time frame and it sends you back the dot. Because different time frames are going to be different names or different locations or different sizes. So there are ways to deal with this, and there's quite a bit between gazetteers and on historical gazetteers that are temporally tagged. But there's a lot of fuzziness in place names. So one place name may be used for several different places, or one place may have several different names. And then you've got a whole bunch of mythical places that you have to deal with. And whether or not you can find a geography for some of these mythical places, that's an interesting exercise as well. Okay, so there's place. Then there's time, and I sort of picked up on the locations and names of places change, and boundaries move around, and people move, and ideas move. So over time, things move around, so their location is not fixed. So when you're trying to find a location, something you also have to know its date, which leads to this spatial temporal desert here. Because humanity's work is all about time, and we're trying to add space, then it sort of builds on one another. You've got to start going down the spatio-temporal road. You've got to start building a spatio-temporal framework for the world. So not just X and Y, you've got to have X and Y in time. So you've got to know where all the cities are over time, not just one unit. Then once we've got that, we've got to start to think about how we analyze in space and time. And the standard GIS tools don't do that. They don't do space and time. And then we need to think about building those tools specifically for humanity, because they're different as well. So there's a lot of work to do. There's a problem of uncertainty, which basically has to do with all this qualitative context. A lot of things that are hard to be specific about in humanity. So, even though we have all these problems, there's lots of really interesting questions in the question of connecting GIS and humanities. One of them is, are the ways that humanities scholars organize their work, data models or ontologies is something we're always talking about in GIS. You have a collection of things, computer scientists do this all the time too. If you want to put a collection of things in the computer, you usually have to categorize them first. But you can put them in nice tables and identify them with different codes. So you're always building these ontologies of the world. And is the ontology set that a humanities scholar is different from the ontology set that a geographer would use to describe the landscape? So my description of landscape, I have hills and rivers and valleys and glaciers. They might have a different ontology of places because of looking at the world in a cultural context as opposed to a physical context. So one question is, do those ontologies match? Secondly, does a computer interface change how a scholar will work? The humanities scholars, their traditions are much more reflective, as I said at the beginning. A lot more looking at different items, sort of sifting through information, going slowly, letting ideas sort of germinate. Does putting it in a computer interface where things are very rigorous and locations are, everything looks precise, is that going to change how a humanities scholar will do their work? It's just an interesting question. Is it going to make a difference? And then how can all of these things we have in GIS change what's going to happen in humanity? Will change it? No, I have this one. Well, the emerging object technology, that's actually, I should take emerging object as well here. The whole object technology in GIS has now been around for about, probably for about 6 years. And it has completely changed the way GIS works. Now we get to see the world as real things rather than point lines and polygons. So we can actually, our ontologies that we put into our databases much more represent the world. So we structure our databases as things now rather than points, lines, and polygons. Will the humanities scholars be able to take advantage of that object technology and start to think about their world through ontology in that kind of a structured sense so that they could, in fact, organize their information in that same way? Can this be a tool that will work for them? Whereas before, the points, lines, and polygons, which are really abstract, are hard for them to move into. If we can give them objects, might it be closer to the way they're thinking? So what you need to make this work is you need people to learn about GIS. You need people to work together because this requires different fields to connect. You need to build bridges between the humanities scholars and the computer scientists with a language issue that has to be managed. And then you need to build an infrastructure to support scholars moving in this direction. Things like best practices, standards, and initiatives like the Electronic Cultural Atlas Initiative. I just put this in here. These are the people that I worked with at Berkeley, and they've done some interesting things, although as I'm looking at their website now, I feel kind of like they got stuck, too. They've been visually making maps, but they haven't taken it through to the scholarship point. So I'm a little disappointed they haven't gone as far as I thought they were going to go. It may imply that you can't be that it's too hard. But going from just putting the dots on the map, everybody can do that, to actually carrying out scholarship from that, it doesn't seem to be bridging that gap. Maybe I just didn't look deep enough in the site, but I was a little disappointed when I looked. So, the moral of the story is, it's 1 minute to eight, well done, is keep the humanity in the humanities. I am not advocating that humanities scholars become GIS practitioners. I think it's very, very important for humanities scholars to keep doing what they're doing, but to investigate how this tool can help them think differently in their own field. So use GIS to develop new insights and knowledge. Use it as a tool for exploration. But don't lose sight of how this has always been done. And this is important. Many fields, including some of the sciences, have done this. You make workarounds, especially in the old days, and GIS was really difficult. You had to, really crunch this thing to make it work. So I've got this wonderful landscape that I want to put in the computer, but I've got points, lines, and polygons, so I'm going to turn everything into points, lines, and polygons. And so the lines are kind of funny looking. They don't really look like the real world because they're sharp angles. And when I zoom in, the rafters blow up and they turn into pixels. And it's not my world. And so one approach is to say, okay, well, I understand what that is, and I'm just going to make do it. I'm going to let lines be angular. The other approach is I won't let lines be angular. I want my lines to stay curved. So I will not accept the technology that makes my lines go angular. So therefore, I have to make the technology go in my direction rather than me changing my way, the way I understand the world, to accept this thing that isn't quite right, to work around. You actually ask the technology to go further, which means that you really have to begin to understand why do you need a curve? What kind of curve do you need? What is that curve giving you? And it really is another deeper way to go into an understanding of the field. So by bumping up against the limits on the technology, there can be a point of understanding that wouldn't be found by not going to that point. So my argument is always don't, with the folks at Berkeley when we started doing this, they were going to, they had the place names, which had all this cultural richness attached to them because they had different names and, long descriptions. And what they wanted to do was figure out those place names and put the XY in the table and throw out the place names. Because then they had the XY. But I said, no, don't do that, because there's a whole bunch of information in that place name and all that description that is much richer than that XY location. And in fact, you might not have gotten it right. So you don't want to throw it out because you might have picked the wrong XY location. So what I was always trying to do is to make them hold on to all the information they had. You can get an XY location and have it to use it, but be ready to remember that, well, actually I can go back and revisit that and redo the method I used now that I understand it better. So the idea is to keep it all there, keep the humanities in the humanities, and test the tool and push the boundaries of their own exploration. And I think that's it. Thank you very much.